Welcome to the meeting of the Academic Affairs, Student Affairs, and Personnel Committee. Ms. Wright, would you please call the roll?
Yes, thank you. Trustee Robert Boy?
Here.
Trustee John Butler?
Here.
Trustee Raquel Chavez? Trustee Wheeler Coleman?
Here.
Trustee Sherilyn Muir?
Here.
Board Chair Mark Strauss?
Here.
Committee Chair Robert Marshall?
Here.
Thank you.
Mr. Blakemore, would you please verify that we have a quorum and that the appropriate notice of this meeting has been posted?
Mr. Chair, we have a quorum and the meeting has been done pursuant to the Illinois Open Meetings Act.
Thank you. May I have a motion to approve the agenda for today's meeting? And a second, please. Thank you. All those in favor? Opposed? Dealing with an approval of the minutes and the review of those items, may I have a motion to approve the minutes of the meeting of May the 28th, 2015?
So moved. Second.
Thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? There are a few comments. Unfortunately, we start with one that will hit you right in the gut, particularly the stomach. Because of economic problems, which are across the state, we unfortunately will not be able to put the usual lunches out or the heavier table of very good pastries in the morning on the committee meetings and the regular board meetings. I hope that all of you will join me in saying that we all hope that the situation will get better. Now, on today's agenda, we do have two items for approval, including a request to delete an emphasis in physical education, grades 6 through 12, within the physical education K to 12 and 6 to 12 educator licensure. This is for the Bachelor of Science in Education program. The second item for approval is an off-cycle tenure request for a new chair of the Department of Literacy and Elementary Education, commonly referred to as LEED. Along with our approval items, there are four information items. The first item is our annual list of faculty emeritus professors. These faculty have retired in good standing and are being given this title in addition to their academic rank. The second item is the recognition of our faculty and staff that have received professional excellence awards. I see that many of these individuals are present today, and we're excited to have the opportunity to acknowledge your contributions. There are a lot of years involved, and you could count blood, sweat, and tears in it. The third item, a presentation on the impact of the Affordable Care Act, is one that I specifically requested, as there will be some new laws going into effect in the beginning of 2016 that may impact our staff and our students. The final update is on the program prioritization process. Provost Freeman has told us that she will provide periodic updates to the board on the process. So we're looking forward to that along with our other items. Before we go into the actual agenda, I would ask, do we have any public comment request?
I have not received any requests for public comment.
Okay, at this time, I would like to recognize the members representing the University Advisory Committee that are in attendance, Professors Dan Gebo and Professor Leanne Vanderkrieg. Do you have any comments that could help us along?
Greg would like to have a few comments, the leader of our group.
Good morning, I'm Greg Long. I'm president of the Faculty Senate and would like to welcome everyone to the start of the fall semester, certainly. We are, as faculty, it's an exciting time of year. It's hard not to get excited to see the students on campus and all The one thing I would say that the excitement that we have is a bit tempered this year with anxiety, certainly, and the budget, the issues that you're all aware of, impact on programs, impact on salaries, and so forth. So that's, from a faculty standpoint, that's certainly one of our concerns, but we do look forward to working collaboratively, both with the administration, Board of Trustees, happy to meet with individuals informally as well as formally to figure out best ways of getting through this challenging time. So just want to say thank you, and we look forward to working together.
I would like to say that an apology is owed you. I did not update my notes, and you will be a well-recognized member of the folks that we depend on for advice.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, at this point, I would like to ask Vice President and Provost Freeman to present the university report.
Great. Before we launch into the agenda, I would just like to add my welcome back to everyone for the beginning of another exciting academic year. Greg Long referred to some of the challenges that we faced, but I want to say that when you look out at the excellence of our faculty and staff, and we will be recognizing some of that excellence this morning, you see a resource that defies anything that Springfield could do in terms of what it brings to our university community, the intellectual life of our campus, and even more than that, when you look out at the students who showed up here on Monday morning and see their interest in everything that's going on our campus, in the world, and you listen to their ideas about what we can do to make this a better university, a better city, a better state, a better nation, you understand that we have so much to be thankful for and so much going for us. So I just wanted to start with something upbeat before launching into item 7A, the request for deletion of an emphasis. The driver for this agenda item is changing state expectations for middle school licensure. And we have here a number of people from the College of Education to give the background before we ask for the recommendation and the vote. I know we have in the audience our new chair, Chad McAvoy, from the Department of Kinesiology and Physical Education. We have Jim Ressler, a faculty member in that department, Sue Schwartz, an academic advisor, Mark Van Overbeck, the associate dean, and I also see Betsy Hull, the business manager, so they have brought a lot of people who can address this issue if necessary. Can the designated speaker please go to the microphone and just provide us with some detail?
Good morning. We brought a crew just so we can represent ourselves as well as possible. It's probably also somewhat rare for someone to come before this group and ask to delete a course or an emphasis, but we think that's in the best interests of our students. Right now, the emphasis on teaching grades 6 through 12 in physical education is redundant as part of the larger emphasis on kindergarten through 12th grade teaching. It does create some confusion among our students. And if they also went into just the emphasis on grades 6 through 12, it would limit their employment opportunities. So by getting rid of this emphasis, we're not harming the students in any way. Very few of them actually want to take this emphasis. They all tend to take the K-12 emphasis. It's better for them. It better meets their needs. And the 6-12 emphasis does not align particularly well with the new middle level program, which is grades 5 through 8. So 6 through 12 would preclude anyone who wanted to work 5 through 8 in the middle level program. So this is really a request to clean up some of the language and to better serve our students and to reduce confusion among them, while also ensuring that they have the best opportunities for getting the best jobs and as many jobs as possible that are out there, K-12 and physical education. And we'd be happy to take any questions.
Yes, please.
I want to take this opportunity to commend you and the provost for the exercise. Deletions are not necessarily something we're looking for, but I think it gives greater credibility to when we ask for additions. It's that we're looking at the full picture, and we're trying to constantly reassess and reorganize the structure in the best interest of the student. So I would be remiss to not take this opportunity to really commend you for your process, not necessarily the specificity of this particular deletion, but the process that you, your college, and the provost office have gone through. And I think we need to continue to do that, to continue to look at where are things that are either redundant or things that are not as timely as they may have been a decade ago. And that makes it much easier for us as a Board of Trustees to then listen and embrace any additions that we might have in the future. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
Are there any students currently enrolled in this emphasis?
None at present.
Thank you.
Other questions or comments?
Okay, in the absence of additional questions, let me reiterate the recommendation. The university recommends that the Academic Affairs, Student Affairs, and Personnel Committee endorse this request and ask that the President forward it by means of the President's report to the Board of Trustees for approval at its September 17, 2015 meeting.
May I have a motion on that recommendation?
Almost.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
Thank you. Moving along to agenda item 7B, our other action item. It also comes to us from the College of Education. It is the request for a recommendation of tenure off cycle for a department chair for the Department of Literacy and Elementary Education. Ann Gregory was hired in with tenure and at the rank of professor. She came to us from Western Illinois University. She is a dynamic and vivacious department chair and is already contributing greatly to the university community. The recommendation brought forward to you here in this item is that the university recommends that Academic Affairs, Student Affairs, and Personnel Committee endorse this request and ask that the President forward it by means of the President's report to the Board of Trustees for approval at its meeting on September 17, 2015.
May I call for a motion for the recommendation to be moved forward to the regular Board of Trustees meeting in September?
So moved. Second.
Thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
All right. Moving along to agenda item 8A. This is an information item. This is our annual recognition of our faculty emeriti. And this year, we will be recognizing more than 30 members of our faculty who retired prior to May 15th, 2015. This is a long list of people who have made incredible contributions to NIU over their years through their activities as members of our faculty, as department chairs, and as deans. The length of the list is influenced by the demographics, the graying of our faculty, like that of faculties at universities around the country. We're seeing the baby boomers move on to different stage of their lives. Of course, in the state of Illinois, we're also seeing decisions influenced by pending changes in pension and retirement benefits. Many of the people listed here have moved on to new challenges, either professional or personal, climbing mountains, farming, gardening, working in the not-for-profit sector in other capacities. But others will continue to contribute to the life of this life of the minds of this university for a long time to come. And part of the way we enable them to do that is by the benefits that we give them in addition to the title of emeriti faculty. So in order to keep these faculty involved, we encourage them to use their professorial rank in retirement. We give them continued access to email, to parking, to the ability to participate in academic courses, to use the libraries, to sit on graduate committees, to continue research projects that might be in process, and to become an active part of our annuitants association. So it's a great pleasure and honor to recognize the contributions of so many individuals, and I hope that you'll join me in giving them a round of applause for their extensive service to NIU. Are there questions or comments from the trustees before we move on? Okay. Our next information item is recognition of the faculty and staff who were awarded awards for excellence in different aspects of our university mission. Many of you were present last spring when these individuals who were selected for the prestigious Presidential Awards and Operating Staff Awards and Undergraduate Instruction Awards and SPS Council or SPS Awards were recognized at banquets in front of their peers. But a tradition that has been at NIU for as long as I've been here for 5 years has been to also recognize these individuals at a Board of Trustees meeting. And I think I was here when Trustee Bowie kind of initiated the practice of asking people in the different ward categories to stand and just share their names and a little bit of information about them. So to that end, I know some people had teaching or committee or staff responsibilities. This is a very busy week with the students back and were unable to join us. So what I'm going to do is just call the award category out and ask people who are in it to stand, and we'll go from left to right for the brief introductions. I don't believe Professor Skronsky is here, but in case he was able to make it, John, are you here to be recognized as the Board of Trustees professor? Okay. Presidential teaching professors. Gulshot, I know, I see Jim Schmidt is in the front row, so I can see him. Can you stand? Is Gulshot here? Okay. Jim, will you just, your name and your department, your interest, quickly?
I'm Jim Schmidt. I'm the chair of the Department of History. I'm a U.S. legal historian. I've been here 20 years, part of my 23rd year. So, and thanks very much for the recognition.
Presidential research professors, I see Sanjeev Basu also in the front row, Ann Britt and Aaron Fogelman. If you're here, will you please join rising?
I'm Sanjeev Basu, I'm the director of the districts. I've been here since 1996, for 19 years. Thank you.
Presidential engagement professors, I see Professor Ledgerwood. I don't see Dr. Thurmeyer, but if he's here, please rise. Our Excellence in Undergraduate Teaching Award recipients. I know Jim Horn was unable to be here. Amanda or Stephen, are you here? I didn't see them. Excellence in Undergraduate Instruction Award. Tim Diamond. Okay. Operating Staff Outstanding Service Award recipients. Chris Atherton, Margaret Berg, Patricia Erickson.
Here.
Someone? Chris, I heard that you were here. Don't hide. Just because your height challenge doesn't mean that we can't find you.
We need the chair to stand up.
Pat, if you could just tell folks how you make the university run. Thank you. Oh, I'm so sorry. Catherine, are you here?
Yes.
Oh, please stand up.
I'm always last. I'll let her go first. I'm with the Career Services Department. I've been with NIU for 14 years, and I opened the Husky Student Food Pantry recently.
Thank you.
And I'm Chris Atherton. I've been here 20 years, and I work in the Office of the Provost, and my list is
And last but not least, our Presidential SPS Staff Award recipients. All who are here, please stand. Betsy?
I'm Betsy Hall. I've been here for 12 years. I started in the NIU Foundation, and I'm now assistant to the Dean in the College of Education.
Thank you. And can I ask again for a round of applause to recognize? Our next information item is slightly less uplifting than the two we did before. As Trustee Marshall indicated, this is a dynamic landscape in terms of the impact on health insurance for students, faculty, and staff because of the Affordable Care Act. And as an information item to help educate all of the campus community about potential effects and the questions we're asking ourselves right now, we've asked a number of individuals to be here. Before I ask for a PowerPoint presentation from our human resources staff, I've asked both Dean Bond and Vice President Weldy to be prepared to make a couple of comments about the impact of the Affordable Care Act on the cost of health insurance to our students, and then we'll follow that with some of the more human resource detail aspects of the Affordable Care Act. So Eric or Brad?
Thank you. I just have a few points to make in regards to the student health insurance program as some added information for you. One is that the student health insurance program here at NIU has been in existence for about 35 years. It is an opt-out program, which means that students who are able to document that they have their own private health insurance can opt out of the university plan. Roughly about 45% or a little bit more of our students receive the student health and are part of the student health insurance program. Some other things is over the past few years, there has been increases in our student health insurance program, and so obviously the issue of cost is something that is very important and something that an issue that we have been dealing with the past few years. In regards to the Affordable Care Act, it has significantly impacted the student health insurance program within the past few years here at NIU. And to give you some examples, there is a no exclusion for pre-existing conditions. In other words, so a student is covered when they come in from the first day of the policy. So if they have any pre-existing conditions, it is not a strike against them. They can be treated. Unlimited medical coverage for medical benefits of policy with a few exceptions. Preventive care, including immunizations, are covered 100% through the program. Well care is covered 100%, which means that annual men's and women's exams the students can receive, and prescriptions are also now covered. As I noted, because of the Affordable Care Act, it has been challenging from the standpoint of trying to keep costs down for our students.
Side and I'll be down to the side. Please, Sharon.
Okay. Excuse me. So let me ask you this question. What I think I just heard you say is because students are opting into the Affordable Care Act, we have less of a denominator, which makes it more costly.
From
an insurance perspective?
No, just from the standpoint of with the Affordable Care Act, there are certain things that we have to provide our students. Which increases the costs for us as we go out and try to negotiate contracts to provide those services for them. And it gets a little bit costly for us.
Okay. Maybe offline we can talk about this because mm-hmm. I'm a little confused about it given that, given the federal subsidies on the Affordable Care Act.
Mm-hmm.
The other part of the question, though, is if we're looking at cost containment, do we negotiate health policies as an individual university, or do we do it collectively among all of the state universities in Illinois?
We are a part of a collaborative unit or community. As it relates to student health insurance, we meet twice a year with all of the other student health insurance centers throughout the state. But I don't think that there has been any kind of we haven't created, how should I say, there's been less collaboration from the standpoint of how can we work together to keep down costs is something that that has not been done. But we do from the standpoint of what other universities are doing and providing health care for their students.
I'd like to make two suggestions.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to look to the president to see if there's ways in which we can work with other universities, not just in a collaborative discussion, but in a cooperative cost containment methodology of greater denominator should reduce costs. So I think that's the first thing. And then also in the Carl Committee, we're going to talk about risk management and opportunities to mitigate mitigate risk, but mm-hmm. risk relates to cost. So maybe we can also incorporate that as we're looking at where we're going in that regard.
Yeah, definitely happy to have those discussions.
Okay.
Brad, did you want
Bob to? Bob had indicated also that he wanted to then Mark and anyone else?
Yes. Yes, sir.
Do I understand that it's because the Affordable Care Act has changed, the cost has gone up?
That has been part of it. I think the question for us is, do we want to remain in the student health insurance business?
That's what I thought you would.
Yes, and so that's the big issue for us. I do think that we go out of our way to make sure that we provide all of the services that we can for our students. Which has not been easy, particularly over the past few years. But I do think that we're at a point now where we need to kind of sit back and kind of have a discussion and question on whether or not this is something that we want to continue.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. That clarifies it.
Mark.
Eric, students can only opt out if they demonstrate proof of other insurance. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
So with respect to student laborers, they have whatever job on campus, mm-hmm. they either are covered by our health insurance or they're covered by somebody else's health insurance. Is that correct?
Well, I think this maybe goes a little bit into the presentation that's coming forward, but if it really doesn't matter from the standpoint of if a student is employed on campus, when they, you know, they're a student first, and so either they have the university's insurance program or they have some private. So whether or not they're working on campus, really, there's no real connection. If I think I'm correct on that, okay.
Thank you.
Just one last comment on this. Before we make any decisions on something that is a drastic turnaround from what we have always done mm-hmm. for decades and decades, and what is pretty customary in a university setting, I think we really need to look at this and investigate different options and also do a bit more analysis. You know, one of the elements of the Affordable Care Act is that you can stay on your parents' insurance until you're 26, and that certainly might impact our undergraduates. On the other hand, given that our population of individuals here sometimes struggle from mm-hmm. economic perspectives, we shouldn't assume that parents have insurance which that student can stay on. So this may be the only alternative for individuals, and my recommendation is let us not be abrupt on this matter, mm-hmm. and I think we need to be creative, and this would be the time to see what can we do collectively in the state of Illinois with other universities.
Okay. Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. I'm not as familiar with the history from the standpoint of Illinois institutions, but I know when I was in Florida for 7 years, that we tried, at the university that I was at, we tried very hard to work with other universities to come together from the standpoint of coming to agreement, developing contracts in order to keep costs down for all students in the state. But at the time, no one was interested. But I think that now, because of the high cost of healthcare and other things, I think that other universities are definitely open to having discussions now.
Well, this might be the right time. You know, it could be a win for universities to show levels of cooperation, and maybe the right time with this governor maybe even through Mike Mann might even be able to investigate. That might be something that might be a legislative win. Mm-hmm. And that's an easy win for the legislature when everyone's complaining about the cost of higher education and the support by the state of Illinois. So, thank you.
Yes.
I think the trustee Muir's point is very good, that if there was a policy answer to this with the public universities working together, that would be preferable to stopping this group health plan and leaving our students to buy insurance on the exchange, because we don't really know what they would qualify for in terms of subsidies as individuals, and it would vary. For some students, it might be very reasonable. For some, it might be very expensive. At least we have a flat rate that we know now that we can offer students. We may want to think about, in the future, the question of how does our existing student insurance program compare to offerings on the exchange in terms of the types of plans and the cost of plans. That's the kind of information I'd be interested in learning if we were thinking about changing the current offering.
Any other comments or questions? Okay, I'll have one, and that thought that with some of the comments that have come out dealing with what I consider a critical issue, would we want to have some recommendations coming through the administration on what we're going to do in the future on it? I'm not saying next week, but it's certainly an issue that I think we have to deal with. So I would ask for a little research to be done, and going from there, Eric, please.
Yeah, I think we've already started that in a sense, because we're always looking and comparing health insurance with other institutions, what they're offering, what they're not offering. But also in-house, we've been having extensive conversations in regards to health insurance. And Brad can definitely speak on that as well.
I also want to remind the trustees that each year they vote to approve our insurance, and so we will certainly be engaging you rigorously in the discussions that we're having on this topic, as well as if there are issues in our state procurement system that prohibit us or make it challenging for us to get the most purchasing power in consortia, we would also be asking for a discussion of those in front of this group. And thank you for all of those excellent comments. As Trustee Muir noted, the issues for undergraduate students and graduate students are not identical. And as a public research university, about 25% of our students are graduate students. And so in addition to asking Vice President Weldy to speak, we've asked Brad Bond, the Dean of the Graduate School, to make some comments on the cost of health insurance before moving into our human resources presentation. Brad?
Yeah, I'll be very brief. Implementation of ACA has been disruptive, to say the least, amongst graduate schools all across the country. It's the pattern that we've seen of increased cost is not uncommon. I can certainly point you to institutions where costs have remained steady over the past few years, but we can also point you to institutions where costs have doubled and trebled at the same time that ours has gone up. This was really driven home to me a couple weeks ago when we had 71 Fulbright scholars on campus for orientation. And one of their hot-button items, they were getting ready to scatter all across the country to go to the institutions where they were going to begin their studies. But one of the hot-button questions for them was, how do I deal with this health insurance business? It was a foreign landscape to them, and the costs were astronomical. I sat in a group with 15 of these students and asked, what are you being charged? and it was all over the map. And it's a cold comfort, but we were on the low end of that spectrum in terms of our cost for student health insurance. That doesn't mean that the cost is easy for our students to swallow. Okay, so it has been very disruptive. The graduate school is part of the Council of Graduate Schools, a national organization, and that listserv and all of the publications that come out of there are chock full of information and concerns about implementation of ACA and the impact on graduate students. So our problem is not a unique one. That doesn't make it any easier to deal with.
I guess I have one final question. Looking at the Affordable Care Act and the different illnesses that it covers, are we getting more coverage for things that were not covered in the past under our old insurance grouping?
Yes, we are. But another comment I think that I need to make in regards to our cost and some of the challenges that we have, I think cost is also impacted from the standpoint of where we are regionally, as well as our students have a very high claims rate in regards to the number of claims that they submit with their health insurance. And so that boosts costs as well.
And I guess lastly, I was totally happy to hear the thought of consortium. It often wins battles that are needed won. Are there any other comments?
Okay, well, to segue to the presentation from Human Resources, I think it's safe to say that any piece of legislation as complicated as the Affordable Care Act will have a variety of intended and unintended consequences. And Dean Bond and Vice President Wells, you spoke eloquently to the direct costs issues and that our students face. We have here Liz Guest and Celeste Latham from Human Resource Services and Greg Brady from the General Counsel's Office to talk about some of the institutional risk associated with the Affordable Care Act and how that can come down and impact students and employees and perhaps unintended consequences. Greg and Celeste.
Good morning, members of the board. Thank you for this opportunity, and your questions actually nicely segue into our presentation, because what you've talked about earlier is the individual mandate for persons to maintain personal health insurance, which our student health insurance can help with. But the question that Chair Strauss had posed about the workforce, our offering of a student health insurance plan does not meet our employer obligation to provide health insurance to our full-time employees. And that's what Celeste and I are going to talk about here. So unfortunately, we can't utilize this student health insurance program to cover our employee mandate to those individuals who may also have an employment relationship with the university. So if we can go to the next slide, this is the employer mandate of the Affordable Care Act. And essentially it boils down to that we have to offer health insurance that is affordable and provides minimum essential coverage to our full-time employees. And the standard under the Affordable Care Act is 30 hours per week or 130 hours per month. This is kind of the outline there of those two standards of affordability and the minimum essential coverage in general terms. If we can go to the next slide. So our responsibility is hinged upon penalties. So there are two primary penalties when it comes to the Affordable Care Act. The first penalty is if we fail as a large employer to offer insurance to those individuals who meet the 30-hour standard or 130-hour standard, we could be looking at penalty A, which is the $2,000 per full-time employees at our institution who meet that standard, excluding the first 30. That could be a substantial penalty because of the size of our workforce. And there's a penalty B, which is if we offer health insurance, but we don't offer it in an affordable sense or a minimum essential coverage sense, we could be looking at penalty B, which is the $3,000 per employee who receives a premium tax credit. And there is a cap on that penalty. It's a much smaller penalty, but it's a penalty. The triggering event for a penalty is if we fail to do one of those two things and one of our employees goes out to the marketplace, gets health insurance from the marketplace, and is provided a tax credit or subsidy from the marketplace and the federal government. So this is the complexities of what we have to manage here. Now, unfortunately, like I said earlier, that this applies to employers. So large employers, small employers. But traditionally, those employers are able to control the health insurance that they provide. We as a public entity in the state of Illinois are not allowed to control our own insurance. That is provided through state law, which can go into the next slide here. The State Employees Group Insurance Act of 1971, and it dictates who gets coverage and what that coverage is. We don't control that at all. So what we've found is that we have employees who get health insurance here, and the state is covering that. We have employees who may or do meet that 30-hour per week standard, and they are not covered through the Illinois law on insurance. We have gap employees. That's what they're commonly known as. And so we've been struggling with the obligations from the Affordable Care Act to try to provide them insurance. And what our options are as far as looking into insurance options individually in a consortium or making policy changes in relation to how we operationalize our employees with those standards in mind. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Celeste.
So the biggest constraint that we're working with as it relates to providing insurance to our gap employees is the fact that in order to be eligible for benefits under central management services, you must be eligible to participate in the Illinois pension plan. So there's an intertwinement of two statutes that provides us with some constraints as it relates to our gap employees, which are our student employees, our grad assistants, extra help, affiliates, and any civil service, SPS, or faculty working less than 50% or who are on contracts of 4 months or less. So our initial steps that we took to try to come up with a solution and mitigate risk was we spoke with Central Management Services on what, if anything, could they do to help us mitigate our risk. Unfortunately, because of the statutory constraints, they were able to provide little assistance to us. So in collaboration with the other universities, we've been working with them over the past 2 years to try to come up with a solution and find a vendor that will be able to provide coverage for our gap employees. So during this 2 year period, we have utilized two consultants. We've issued one request for information, three requests for proposals, and unfortunately to date, no bids were received to provide coverage to our employees. So we started beginning the next steps with the other universities on being able to limit the number of hours so that we could lessen the risk of employees working more than 30 hours and us not being able to provide coverage. We received notification yesterday. We have a potential emergency procurement that we're exploring with the other universities that might be able to help us with a possible solution. So given the constraints that we've been working on, the steps that we've been working towards for compliance to date is we reviewed all of our processes and our reporting mechanisms because we're going to need to be able to accurately depict who's working 30 hours or more. We limited extra help to 25 hours per week. Review of the affiliate category determined that that category can actually be eliminated. Duties are now being encompassed in other employment categories that are a better fit. We've been working with departments on accurately reporting FTE for the gap area employees. For student employees specifically, we're working with departments on eliminating what's called the negotiated rate category, and it's where we're paying student employees more like a salaried employee. And we've also been reducing the number of hours above the 20 that they could work. Currently, students are eligible to work up to 30 hours, so we've reduced that to 5 extra hours for a cap of 25 hours. For grad assistants, they're limited to 20 hours per week, and then extra employment will only be available to those graduate assistants that are on assistantships that are less than 20 hours.
Questions?
When you talk about employment of 30 hours a week, how many weeks a year is someone usually employed?
It varies by employment
category.
Generally speaking. Generally, they're employed for a 9-month period.
So generally, it's not 52.
Correct.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So one thing to think about might be, in order to balance any harm to a student worker, would this be compliant if someone worked 25 hours a week and then remain under the student insurance? And in order to address the financial gap of those 5 hours times the number of weeks, you increase, one thing might be to increase the number of weeks per year. Or, and that's to keep someone whole. If we choose not to keep someone whole, then all of those individuals who are working less than 30 hours, would not the option of the student insurance be made available to them?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, but that'll only cover then the student employment categories. So that is.
And what percentage is, maybe one thing in the future you might be able to do a pie chart to help us see what the differential is in terms of the impact. So when we look at graduate students, any student type individual that would have eligibility to the other type of insurance, what percentage of the pie is that, generally speaking?
Generally, it's over 50%. We hire about 3,200 students per year, okay, and about 1,200
grads. So maybe
that's
something to from a policy standpoint, to think about. And there are two options that I just described, and one is to keep them entirely whole. That's not possible, then maybe the alternative has greater merit from a policy standpoint than the alternative. So I think that there's opportunities that you might want to consider in this.
John?
Mr. Brady, you said that the penalty is triggered by the by the purchase of insurance on the exchange?
Yes, it is, well, it's multiple events. So we have to first fail to do one of the two things, which is either fail to offer insurance that is affordable and minimum essential coverage, and then one of those employees who was supposed to be offered such insurance goes to the marketplace and gets the subsidy. That would trigger the penalty A. So the second scenario is we offer insurance. It is not either affordable or provides minimum essential coverage or both. Same thing where the employee who should have had that goes to the marketplace, gets insurance, and gets a subsidy. That triggers penalty B.
So there's no workaround if the employee could demonstrate that they are a participant in a group plan other than the CMS plan?
It, I don't believe so, because it's the employer-provided insurance that's the key. That's why we can't use the student health insurance as a substitute. So I would have to know what health plan we're looking at, but if it's not provided by either the state or NIU, I'd probably have a hard time arguing that would meet the test.
What about collectively bargained health plans for temporary employees? So say you have temporary employees who do carpentry work, for example, over the summer, who might have coverage through their union.
Yeah, I don't, and again, if it's not provided by us.
Okay. I mean, I know this is a huge issue for the public universities, and I think, these are some of the really complex issues that the Affordable Care Act raises, and I appreciate the work that you've done here.
Wheeler?
You confused me in just a comment you just made.
Sorry.
Utilizing the student insurance, I thought we said might be possible if it were under 30 hours.
No, it is not. It is never a substitute. The under 30 hours in your scenario is
yes.
the triggering event. If we keep the
right,
employment.
That's what I'm saying. So In that case, yes.
Okay. Exactly. Okay. Because we're talking about the individual mandate when we talk about
that. I appreciate that. Okay. I just wanted a point of clarification on that.
Yeah, you know, I'd like to get some more understanding of us shopping around trying to get an insurance company to provide us with this gap insurance. Coming from an insurance company, I find it hard to believe that we can't get anybody to bid on that. You said there was some other action that was occurring in the space?
The challenges that we faced in trying to get a company to provide coverage is twofold. One, we can't guarantee minimal enrollment, and so that was a deterrent for employees or for vendors. The other one was we can't give a claims history. The only, across the entire state, the only information we could provide was general age and zip code where they lived. And so we couldn't give them any claims history as far as individual insurance requirements or needs before that. And so the feedback that we received from vendors who might have participated in like inquiries and trying to determine if they wanted to bid was that was one of their deterrents. So we've been frantically working to see if there's still another provider out there that maybe wasn't targeted or didn't respond to our initial request.
So we're not the only institution that's facing this challenge.
No, and we one of the reasons why we used all of the universities is because we were hoping that the larger number of people who needed to be insured across the state would hopefully minimize the dollar amount and help us meet the affordability prong of the test.
Thank you. You know, there is a concern, you know, students that have a need to work 30 hours is also trying to fulfill a need, right? And so how do they live on campus or live off campus to pay some of their expenses and to lower their expenses of coming to this institution? Capping their hours to 20 or 25 will have an adverse impact, and we've got to realize that for what that means is some students may have to seek alternative ways or other institutions because of it. We're squeezing them out, right? We're taking in some cases maybe food off their plate. So if there's any effort that we can do to continue to try to get some creative insurance company out there to bid on this body of work, I would encourage us to do so.
Yeah, we still continue our efforts with the other universities.
One other comment on that is we've also taken this, not this exact presentation, but a similar presentation around to different constituencies within the institution, and that has come up a lot. And people have been very willing to try to find solutions to how can we get a health history, how can we, you know, if obviously the impact is going to be that one student is not going to be able to work 30 hours and only 25 hours, well, maybe that opens an opportunity for another student to get employed for a different opportunity, both of them being under the 25. So we've been really grateful for the feedback. Unfortunately, that we're running up against the clock for this year, so we got to implement something for this year, but then we want to keep that in mind for future years because this is going to be a continuing obligation for us. So,
we talked about, if you don't mind, we talked about the cost component of it, and I haven't heard any numbers. What do we anticipate the additional cost of insuring the gap in the gap students?
With what was provided to us in the emergency purchase proposal yesterday, we're still looking at that feedback to estimate the costs. So we can provide that to Provost Freeman in the future once we're done with that analysis.
Okay. I want to remind everybody the purpose of ACA. Remember, it was designed to try to take cost out of and lower the cost curve for health insurance for the entire nation. Keep in mind our GDP, we spend 17% of our GDP, about $3 trillion on health care, and that's the largest of any industrial nation. So we've got to find a way to lower the cost. If we have uninsured, the uninsured is driving up a significant amount of cost in the health care industry, and so that's the reason why we want insurance, and we want all of our students to have insurance to help keep the cost out of the entire system down. And when we put proposals on the table or even consider proposals on the table that would take insurance away, it's gonna have an adverse impact. We may save on one side of the equation, but it's gonna overall increase the cost of care for everybody. So we need to be careful here. Thank you.
If there are no further comments, I would like to say thank you.
And I would like to add my thanks, and I would like to assure the Board of Trustees that no one in the senior leadership of this university believes that capping hours is a great solution to the challenge that we face. We're eager to work with you and with others in the state of Illinois to procure gap insurance, and when we consider the cost benefit of a gap insurance policy, we will consider not only the impact on our students, which all of the trustees expressed concern of, but also the impact on our institution. Our temporary employees are critical to the function of this university. Just because they don't work full-time doesn't mean that we don't depend on them. And capping those hours has a dramatic individual and institutional effect, and we'll consider that as we go forward. Okay, I'm going to move now to our final information item, 8D. When the board expressed a resolution in support of program prioritization, I agreed that we would provide periodic updates. These updates don't fall neatly into the purview of any one committee, and so we are rotating them across committees as appropriate for the activity. I've asked Vice Provost Carolyn DeDouglas, our Vice Provost for Academic Planning and Development, to give the update this morning. As co-chair of the Coordinating Council facilitating this process, she's been working diligently with more than 100 people on campus to move this initiative forward, and I believe it's appropriate for her to talk about that activity. Thank you, Carolyn.
Thank you, and good morning. As Provost Freeman said, you'll get some regular updates. I know that she has previously updated a different committee on the basic purposes, processes, and expected outcomes of this exercise and program prioritization. And today I'll just give you, and especially given the time, a very brief update on the progress that we have thus far, a little bit about the communications that we're doing, and actions that we expect to see after the rankings are completed in late April, early May. But first, as she mentioned, there's over 100 people that have been working on this. If you could imagine for just a moment 100 people standing here with me, there are people that have been doing data loading, there are people who have been doing criterion development, there are people who have been doing communications. This is an effort that has been campus-wide, and I just want to give thanks, a general thanks, to the individuals who have been involved in that, many of whom actually are sitting in the room today, and many of whom are back in their offices hard at work. And just say one of the things that I really appreciate about this process is that at every turn, people have stepped up to the plate, and that is what NIU is about, and I appreciate being a part of that. I also have to say that we wouldn't be where we are today if it weren't for the leadership, if it weren't for President Baker and Provost Freeman, Vice President Al Phillips, and of course all the senior leadership that have been involved in being supportive and championing this cause, and of course all of you, and we appreciate all that's going on today with the Board of Trustees. So where are we today? I will ask you to go to the next slide. In fall of 2014, as you may know, we had our initial exploration of program prioritization with a team that went to an academic impressions conference, listening to Bob Dickison and Larry Goldstein talk to us about the process. From that, we developed a coordinating team which is overseeing the process, as, again, Provost Freeman mentioned, from start to finish. So we've been involved in this since about October of 2014. We had some preliminary communications, and we continue to have those ongoing with the campus community. And at the very beginning, we began an evaluation process. And I'm very proud of that evaluation process, and at some point later, we'll hopefully bring you some of the results from that, because we're one of the few institutions that's actually doing formative evaluation and making process improvements as we go along, rather than just doing a summative evaluation at the end. In spring, this past spring, we established the guiding principles, defined the enormous lists of academic and administrative programs. There's over 200 of each type. We developed the criteria using a shared governance process, first with a survey that was passed out throughout the campus, and then with the Academic Planning Council and Resource Space and Budget Committee of the University Council. And that process was led by former faculty Senate President Bill Pitney. We had the task force nomination process, which is open to everybody on campus to make nominations. We had well over 100 nominations. We had another group that was selected to make the selection of the individuals on the task forces, and they were selected. And if you don't know this already, I just mentioned David Chagnon is the chair of the academic task force, and Michelle Pickett is the chair of the administrative task force. And we're very fortunate, I think, to have both of those individuals. This summer, we've had a data support team that has been in full swing. Last May, Vice President Coriel stepped up to the plate to help us put together a data support team, including a project manager, and we have been working with them all summer to develop data, to get it put together, and to get it loaded into a system for this process. Communications support team also came up with a communications plan that we'll be implementing or have already started to implement this fall. Harlan's group was very important in that, as well as Ann Kaplan has loaned us some of the talent from her shop as well. Task force training, we've developed a task force training plan, and we've been having ongoing meetings all summer with the task force chairs. Coming up this fall, the training will kick off and the official charge will be delivered to the task forces on September 3rd and 4th. Then training will be set up for all the training, for all the individuals who are actually writing the programs or approving the programs. And we again have probably close to 400 people who will be involved in that. We're bringing in a panel of experts from other universities that have gone through this process before in October. And there's been a group that's been working on putting that together. And that will coincide during the period where people are writing the narratives, approving the narratives. And we expect all of those to be approved by December of 2015. At that point, our training team will step back in again, working specifically with the task forces themselves to train them in the system. The system, by the way, is called Program Prioritization. That's the name of the, Prioritization Plus. That's the name of the system that we're using for the data. And helping them to norm their scoring. And actually, we had a very good conversation just yesterday with Vice President Blasey regarding the norming processes. And we're going to make sure that there's rigor and integrity in that process as well. Next. In the spring, the task forces will prioritize programs into five equal categories or quintiles and provide recommendations to the senior leadership. What you're seeing here is a set of generic quintile names. Part of the September 3rd and 4th training will be them actually, that task force is actually deciding what they want to call them. But basically, the generic process is that you'll have a group that is candidates for enhanced resources, a group that is basically everything's going fine, continue, and no change in resources, a group that maybe is continue as is, but a candidate for reduction of resources. Perhaps things could be done less volume or greater efficiency. And then two that are not performing as well. One that requires transformation, that is, it is critical to our mission. We can't eliminate it, of course, but we need to figure out a way to make it more effective and efficient. And the second, a candidate for elimination. And again, this is a recommendation for a candidate for elimination or to consider for further review, but it would be subject to our normal processes and procedures of shared governance. After that, a student association panel will be looking at the recommendations, as well as Faculty Senate and any other shared governance groups that want to reflect on the task force rankings and provide their own recommendations and comments to the senior leadership. And then the senior leadership will determine resource allocations, not just for fiscal year 17, but beyond as well. Then some really tough work begins, the implementation. And so we'll get to that in about a year or so. Next. I wanted to just point out some of the communications that we have been providing to the campus community, communications that we appreciate the support of the senior leadership and all of you in reiterating when you're able to. The first is, program prioritization is an opportunity for NIU to improve our alignment of resource allocation with our priorities to better serve our students. We're looking for creative and innovative ways that people can reflect on their own processes and come up with their own ideas about how we can make this a better place. Second, it's a chance to increase program efficiency and quality across the university. Again, we're hoping that people will look at that on their own locally as well as within the task forces. Third is an inclusive and transparent process, including shared governance groups, peer review, a comprehensive website. I'll show you in a second a picture of that website. But as everything is at NIU, we're trying very hard to make things very inclusive and very transparent. Fourth is a process with rigor and integrity, which will result in a more data-informed culture and hopefully a greater data infrastructure on campus. Certainly that's what's happening with Prioritization Plus, and hopefully that will move on as we move forward. And then lastly, although program prioritization was not created as a response to the current budget crisis, we hope it may help NIU in finding a path out of our current fiscal crisis and be part of a larger set of initiatives that we're working on at NIU to help us with our fiscal concerns. Next is a picture of the website. If you haven't looked at that, I would encourage you to do that frequently. It is updated quite often. I think the most recent one here is August 11th, but there's another one coming out this week. Harlan's group, again, has done a wonderful job helping us to develop this website. And it's our primary means of communication, although there also are NIU stories, there's surveys, there's all kinds of ways in which we are letting people know about what we're doing. Last, I want to talk a little bit about the action in the implementation phase. So this will be a year down the road. But once the task forces provide the recommendations to the senior leadership, there's a series of things that they'll be looking for. The first is a commitment to act upon those recommendations in fiscal year 17, as well as 4 to 5 years beyond. So we've had conversations with senior leadership, most notably with Al Phillips, about the fact that this needs to happen in multiple years. We're obviously not going to make huge changes the very first year, given particularly the timing of the rankings. Secondly, there needs to be a commitment to work with units that are negatively impacted to assist with retraining as needed. Third, a commitment to maintain the data-informed culture and build an ongoing data infrastructure. And fourth, a commitment, as always, the expectation of this administration, a commitment to open and transparent communications from the top down. So I will just end with a quote from Bob Dickinson, basically indicating the importance of championing and strong leadership for us to make this successful. Thank you. Questions?
Go to the authoring of the reports or the narratives. So if I'm, let's say I'm the NGOLD program, would each of the majors be a separate program under that, or would just?
So for the academic programs, so there's academic and administrative programs. For the academic programs, a major is an individual program.
Okay.
A minor that doesn't have a parent, if you will, so a minor that doesn't have a major that's related to it is an individual program, but if a minor has a parent or has a related major, then those go together.
Okay, so just as an example, mm-hmm. If I'm the NGOLD program,
yeah.
who would you look to author that narrative? Would it be the personnel who's responsible for the administration of that program?
That particular one, I believe, is Nancy Castle.
Yes.
Yes. It would be basically the chair or the director of the program. And that person has the ability, that's the first author, but that person, there can be multiple authors in the system, so that person has the ability to request additional authors as he
okay.
or she sees fit.
Thank you.
I have lots of thoughts running through my mind on this, but I think the first one is an appreciation for the sensitivity of such a complex and impacting process. Mm-hmm. And so the inclusion of so many people is certainly appropriate. I wish, patience is not my greatest virtue, so I wish I could get in a time capsule and get to next year on this, because there's a sense of urgency, in particular in the identification of who we are, and that
yeah.
goes to marketing, that relates back to student enrollment. And I think that that's one of the benefits that I hope will come out of this is a reiteration of who we are and where the strengths are. I mean, if you go back 50 years and you said, who is NIU? NIU Teachers College immediately. We need to have that type of response particular areas of expertise, defining who we are, I think will really help us in the marketplace to distinguish ourselves. So this work is critical. I know that you've taken it so seriously, and everyone here is seeing it, hopefully. There's a subconscious trepidation, I am sure, and everyone seems to be fighting that natural sense of the unknown. But if we all stay focused to the fact that we represent, and certainly this Board of Trustees represents not any individual, but
yes.
represents the posterity of Northern Illinois University now and in several decades to come. So this is probably the most critical work that's occurring, and unfortunately we have tremendous outside pressures mm-hmm. that are going to determine what the results are. So, good job.
Thank you, and I just wanted
moving forward.
Thank you. I wanted to echo something you said about having. We call it the trustee mentality, having the mentality of the entire university on the part of the task force members, and they've been told that, they will be trained for that, they've been selected for that, and that's something that we really want, and we think the people that we have will have that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I need your help. I'm an engineer at heart, so I'd like to find the simplest way to understand something.
Okay.
Let's pick a subject of the engineering school. Let's say it's mechanical engineering.
Yes.
How do you attack that one on this prioritization program that we're talking about?
Well, if there is a specific major within the field,
engineering.
Mechanical engineering, so the BS in mechanical engineering, that will be a program
right.
that will be reviewed under the academic task force.
From a viewpoint of cost as well.
From a viewpoint of cost, revenues, enrollments, quality and student engagement, faculty outcomes, student achievement.
Say again?
Potential growth.
All right.
But
ultimately, what's the bottom line? What are we looking at here? How do you group all those variables together and get to a bottom line?
Right.
That's
so,
what I'm struggling with.
So basically, there's a group of 21 people. They will look at, in each task force, they will look at components of the criterion that have been selected. There's 8 criterion that have been selected for the academic side, 5 for the administrative, and there's a series of questions within the Prioritization Plus system, and there is, people will be uploading data now that are central data related to cost and enrollments, et cetera, but people will also be uploading locally qualitative information, their own quantitative information that they have that are at a local level, and they'll be making the case about why their program is important and meets the criteria. Then the task force will rank those, and again, we're working with Jerry Blasey on some of the ranking techniques that we may need to incorporate to make sure we don't have drift and have some statistical anomalies. And so that process will occur. There'll be some judgment, obviously, subjective judgment as well within the task force, and that is where the trustee mentality really comes in. That if a program ends up in a place based on raw numbers where maybe it really doesn't belong, there'll be some opportunity for judgment to come into play for the individuals to say, we do need this, it is critical to our mission, and we may need to move it into a different category.
So the number of people involved and the number of programs involved is huge,
yes.
Obviously.
Yes. There's over 200 in each task force, over 200 programs, about 224 in the academic, and I think it's about 250 in the administrative programs. So everything is being looked at, everything from janitorial services to snow removal to the president's office to athletics, everything's being looked at. And so those programs will be looked at in a rigorous and methodical way through this software system and through this process that will take a very long time and through a lot of conversations with the task force members.
Thank you.
And what that will result in then is a series of recommendations that is for the senior leadership.
Great, thank
okay.
you.
Wheeler?
So first of all, I want to say that this body of work is really important. I like my colleague next to me, I agree, I'm a little concerned about the timeline that's in front of us.
And you would like it to be longer?
No, not longer.
Shorter.
Trust me, not longer. I'm really concerned because I don't know if we have the time. We're going to be faced with some tremendous decisions long before we get to the fiscal year 2017. And I think this is a body of work that we have to do and we need to continue to do it. I think as part of this work, we also probably need to maybe have some tiers, even within the recommendations of KEEP, maybe have some tiers to a point where if we've got to compress based on financial pressures that we're having, if we've got to compress services within the university, we may have some services that we want to keep, but because of the financial constraints, we may have to get rid of. And so there's a prioritization process that we probably need to also include in this that says even if we think it's good for the institution, even if we think there's great potential for growth, we may have to cut it anyway. And that's a hard pill to swallow.
Yes.
Unless we can find some other financial relief. But the way things are going right now, I think we need to plan for the worst. And that's kind of my only recommendation.
Yeah.
I think Dr. Baker, we're going to find ourselves in a situation where not only we're going to be cutting the breakfast for the trustees, but we'll probably be cutting a whole bunch of other things, but long before this program is done. And I'm concerned that some of the critical work that we need to get done won't be available to us before we have to make some additional cuts.
Thank you. We are going to have to make reductions before the end of this. Vice President Phillips will speak to us in a few minutes about the budget for the university. So we've been going through budget reduction planning without this process. And in an ideal world, we would have started this 2 or 3 years ago or 10 years ago, so that we would be allocating our resources to the greatest need and use. But didn't happen, but we are underway. It took a while to get the complexities put together and the structure put together, and we're moving forward. But absent that, we started a year ago a new budgeting process inside the institution. We made budget reductions last year. We're going through the same process this year. It's been collaborative with the provost and executive vice president and the vice president for finance, meeting with the other divisional leaders and their leaders. So we are going to put together a budget reduction process prior to this. We have to. But this is a better process. It's more inclusive of the university and takes a deeper dive into all the pieces. I think it's also starting conversations about revenue. Where do we grow our revenue? How do we do our processes more efficiently and effectively? So I think it's an ongoing process we're going to have to invest in. We'll get there. Time capsule, I wish we were back 2 years ago instead of where we are today with it, but we are moving. And thank you to Carol Linda and the hundreds of people that have already been working on it.
Thank you.
Other comments? I have a comment on one of the terms that you used, retraining. I'd like to come back to the present rather than the near future. Are we into cross-training at this point in time, and how deeply are we into it?
I think that we do have some aspect of that. I'd like to ask if Provost Freeman would like to talk about that in terms of HR.
Units vary in the degree to which they currently cross-train employees. As a result of the fiscal challenges that the university has faced and the inability to refill every vacancy as it become available, we have done a number of reorganizations, changing of position descriptions, cross-training across units, moving towards shared services within colleges or divisions or units, and cross-training has become an essential part of that. From what you saw in Vice Provost Douglas's presentation, and what you heard from Trustee Coleman and Trustee Muir and the President, we are going to not be able to continue to do everything we've always done the way we've always done it. But that also doesn't mean that we're going to be eliminating valuable employees as we stop, change our activities, change programs. People who are committed to NIU, who are Huskies, who bleed black and red, who take pride in being a member of this community, very talented people. And when we have to change the program that they've been affiliated with, offering them an opportunity to contribute to the university and offering them the resources that are needed for their development to allow that to happen also has to be an institutional priority. We're facing a difficult fiscal situation now, but program prioritization is not just about cutting, and that's not just lip service. It's about being a data-informed culture that makes sure our resources remain aligned with our mission. And I would be advocating for this process with all its complexity in times of wealth as well as in times of scarce resources. And this is not a one-off. This is the beginning of a new way of doing business at NIU to make sure that we are good stewards of public funds and that we're serving the needs of our students in our region to the best of our ability.
Any additional commentary? Okay, Lisa, back to you.
Thank you. This concludes the university report.
Okay. There is one other matter to come before the committee. I guess it would fall into personnel. Many of our staff members are civil service, so I wanted to give you a very quick update. As we are talking, the three finalists for the executive directorship of the Civil Service Commission for the state universities, those three candidates are being interviewed now, and when we come to the next full board meeting, I should be able to give you the name of the successful candidate. Are there any other matters that need to come before the committee? If not, I can set the next meeting date as November 12th, 2015, and ask for a motion for adjournment.
So moved.
Do I have a second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Adjourned.